Well, I'd asked for permission to be sought to speak not on the given verse, but to continue as I'm going around different places speaking on Sri Vishnu Sahasranama. So I continue to do that. Oh, you got it. Okay. Well, if you just excuse me a minute, I'll just set this up. Thank you. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Name 62, Trikokodhama. Who ever heard that name before of Vishnu? Not such a well-known name. Only if you are familiar with Vishnu Sahasranam would you know this name. It's an unusual name, and not only is unusual means it's not a commonly spoken name, nor a name that we commonly see in Shastra. It's also, unless one is somewhat versed in Sanskrit, it's not an easy name to understand what it means. Just like if there are names like, just before this, is Ishana. So we can understand that. Isha means the controller. Before that was Pavitram. Also, so there's easy names to understand if we know. Even in the Indian language. So this is an unusual name. There are three words in it. Tri is the first. Dhamma is the last. And in between, it can be Kakub or Kakut, according to Sanskrit grammatical rules. The B and the T before a D becomes a the also. So three means three. It's clear. Kakub means the direction, just like east, west, north, south, up, down, these directions. And kakut, what is it? Kakut, or it must be kakut. The hump, such as the hump on the back of a bull or the peak of a mountain. And dhamma, the general meaning is abode, residence, and it also means a ray of light or brilliance. So putting these various meanings together, then various understandings of this name arise. And of course, for those who are especially inspired by Saraswati, they can find many, many meanings in every name. Madhvacharya, he wanted to give 100 meanings to every name, but the most apparent meanings are discussed by the commentators. So if dham is taken to mean brilliance, then Trikakut will have to be taken as a separate name. So according to the Parasha or Bhartar of the Sri Vaishnava Sampradaya, he takes Trikakut to mean Varaha Dev, the form of the Lord, as a boar who appeared with three horns. So you probably don't remember from Srimad Bhagavatam that Varaha Dev had three horns, but there is a quotation here from Mahabharata with exactly these words, Trikukudaha. Tataiva asam Trikukudo Varaham rupam astitaha Trikakut tena vikata sharirasya pramapanat, in which Bhagavan states that I assumed the form of a boar with three horns, so I became known as Trikakut. So that's the story. With that form I killed the demon. So that's the directly taking from Shastra, this name Trikakut. however, generally the name Trikakudhama is taken as one name, because you can split the words can be extracted separately. So you can either have Trikakudhama as one name or Trikakut as one name and Dhamma as another. But generally the commentators, they take the two names, three words together as one name. So, another understanding that Parashara Bhatta gives is that Trikukudhama means he whose abode are the three quarters. Because in Shastra it's stated that the spiritual world is three parts and the material world is one part. So in that way it can be given. Now, if three is taken to mean, in general, three groupings, then the name Trikukudhama becomes synonymous with the name Triadhish, which you maybe remember from Srimad Bhagavatam, the Lord of all threes. So there are so many threes. There are three Purusha avatars, Karna Dakashai Vishnu, Garbha Dakashai Vishnu, Kshira Dakashai Vishnu, the three modes of material nature, the three divisions of the material universes, each has upper, lower, and planetary systems. There are the three Murti, Vishnu, Brahma, Mahesh. There are Krishna's own three residences, Vrindavan, Mathura, Dwaraka, three modes of material nature. Krishna's three principal Shaktis, Vishnu's, Sri, Bhu, and Nila. So in this way, there are the six most prominent opulences of the Supreme Lord are grouped into pairs. So we get Jnana and Bala, Aishvarya and Virya, Shakti and Teja. They're put together. So in this way, the Lord of all threes. They're the three states of consciousness. Jagrata, Swapna, Sushupti. Waking, dreaming, and deeply asleep. So these are various meanings of the name Trikukudhama. So name 63. Pavitram. Pavitram means purity. So Krishna is purity. Pavitram paramam. In Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna addresses Krishna. Pavitram paramam bhavan. You are the supreme pure. Another name which pertains to this in Srimad Bhagavatam, Amogha Lila, whose pastimes are without any taint. They are completely pure. Now this is important point to understand, because commonly Krishna is accused of being impure. And especially Christians in proselytizing in India, they want to point out that our Jesus is very good and your Krishna is very bad. So better have Jesus as God. And even followers of Ram, some of them, they're not really followers of Ram, or, well, those who do, with an incomplete understanding, they say, our Ram was very good, but your Krishna is not very good. Our Ram is very moral, your Krishna is immoral. But of course, Rama also gets accused in various ways by various foolish rascals. So, how is Krishna pure? How can we understand that Krishna is pure when he associates with others' wives? He's known as a thief. He's known as a coward, running away from the battle. He's known as a killer. He kills even his own relatives, in the case of Kamsa. But for all these activities, he is glorified. And by glorifying these pastimes, oneself becomes pure. Krishna is the supreme pure. That he is inherently pure. Why is that? Because he has no ill intent toward anyone. He only wishes good for everyone. So everything he does is good. It may be taken as bad by persons who have the wrong intention to enjoy this world separately from Krishna. So for them it seems very bad that Krishna induces Yudhishthira to lie, because after all Duryodhana wasn't so bad, and Rama, he could have just picked himself up another girlfriend. Why did he go to all the trouble of going down to the south and attacking our Dravidian Ravana, and who was actually a good, wasn't such a bad, nice guy, Ravana. And Rama spoiled the whole party. They're having a nice party on Lanka, and Rama came and messed it all up. So in this way they will criticize, because materialistic people, demons, they want to enjoy this world separately from Krishna, and they criticize Krishna and Rama for disturbing their plans. But actually such persons are impure, even though they may claim to be well-wishers of others. The very nature of consciousness that is not pure Krishna consciousness is that it is fully imbued with the exploitive tendency. The natural constitutional position of the jiva is to serve Krishna and to love Krishna. The opposite of that is the tendency to enjoy this world separately from Krishna. Atendriya priti vancha tare balekam krishnendriya priti ichadhare premanam. The desire to enjoy separately from Krishna is called kama, or material lust. And the desire to satisfy Krishna's senses, not one's own senses, that is called prema, or pure love. Now, in kama, if one is not wanting to serve Krishna, then there must be material desire, because the living being is by nature sentient, desireful. So when one desires to enjoy separately from Krishna, then there comes karma, material desire, from karma comes krodha, lobha, moha, mada, matsarya, and all other bad qualities. From lust comes anger, greed, pride, illusion, envy, and all other bad qualities. So these are all impure, harm-producing. Even though certain demons, they may speak of human rights and welfare activities, but because their desire is to enjoy this material world, their attempts to do so, even in cooperation with others, is necessarily incomplete at best, and certainly faulty also. So we see in the modern world, still most of the people who profess human rights, they never even think about animal rights, that so many millions, billions, literally billions of animals are killed every year. And even those who are ecologically hip and vegetarians, if they don't recognize Krishna, then they cannot be free of the exploitive tendency. Even they want to heal the earth, or they have the idea of ecologically friendly exploitation of the earth. They call it green fuel, when it's not really green, but it just pollutes less than others. Or they have these windmills, but the windmills and the appliances that they are set up to run all require factories and mines, and so they're all harming the earth. And even if one lives very simply without directly harming the earth, if one is not living for the sake of Krishna, then the earth is not pleased, and by the unavoidable principle of this material world, jivo jivasya jivanam, one jiva lives on the life of another, then exploitation is unavoidable. So sattva-gun, where one lives very simply, that is desirable. But without Krishna consciousness, nothing is fully pure. Only Krishna is fully pure. By coming in contact with Krishna, one becomes free of base desires. So from this we can understand that Krishna is pure. And also, in so many ways, philosophically we can understand, Krishna is accused of dancing with others' wives, but actually those gopis, they are Krishna's internal pleasure potency. And actually, everything belongs to Krishna. So it's not that Krishna is immoral for dancing with others' wives. Any person who thinks, this is my wife, he is immoral, because everyone and everything belongs to Krishna. So being married is certainly better than just having a girlfriend. But even that is not fully proper understanding. If one thinks this wife or this husband is meant for me, everything should be understood. Everything and everyone should be understood as Krishna's. So any deviation, even from that understanding, that is impure and leads to the exploitive tendency. So Krishna is pure because within Krishna there is no lust, greed, anger, envy, pride, illusion, any of these bad qualities. But if we see Krishna, there seems to be so much desire, so much anger. But again, that has to be understood. That is, it is there, but it is non-harm producing. Krishna's anger, that is beneficial for the objects of it. Krishna's everything, Krishna's lust. By hearing about Krishna's lusty affairs, apparently lusty affairs, then we ourselves become free from the mundane lustful tendency. So Krishna is the supreme pure. He is pure and he purifies others. That is the test of purity. In this material world, some items may be considered pure, but they can become impure by contact with impure substances. Just like milk is pure, but if some alcohol is put in there, then it becomes impure. Alcohol is very impure because that cannot be purified if anything touches alcohol. But, well, just like some clothes, if one is sleeping in some clothes, then they're impure. So the clothes can be purified by washing. But some items are so pure that they're always pure, just like the conch shell is always pure. Nevertheless, if one blows it because one's saliva is impure, although according to some, anyway, I won't get into that, then one should wash that or purify that from this. But the conch itself is inherently pure. But Krishna, for him, there is no question of impurity in Krishna. The water purifies the conch shell, but the purifying agencies, there are so many purifying agencies. The wind, Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, pavanam pavanam asmi. It's pavanam pavanam asmi. The wind, Krishna says, among purifiers I am the wind. So that purifying capacity comes from Krishna. Krishna is always completely pure. Krishna is so pure that even by saying his name, one becomes purified. The name of Krishna is non-different from Krishna. Even by saying the name of Krishna, what is that? Hela, Stobha, Sanket, and Parihas. Even neglectfully, to indicate something else, jokingly, in any way one says the name of Krishna, that is purifying. Even one has no idea it is the name of Krishna. If someone's just, that example is given, a Muslim, they may say haram, which means something, they're calling out, this is something very bad. But because they say the name of Ram, they're purified. Or even if one says one syllable in a sentence and then another syllable later in the sentence, then that's... I think of a sentence. Hurrah for Ma people. It's not very good. Anyway, I had to think it up on the spot. Hurrah, rah, 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 for Ma. That's a mispronunciation of my. Hurrah for Ma people. So you said hurrah for Ma. So you got rah, ma. So still one gets the result of saying the name of Rama, even though there's absolutely no thought of Rama whatsoever. So purifying is Krishna, Rama. So Krishna is the supreme pure. He is the means of purification. Purification, of course, there are different levels like that. The cloth becomes pure. The body after sleeping, we should bathe, especially if we are to worship the deity. But the most important purity is inner purity. The mind should be free of contaminations of lust, anger, greed, etc. So, yes, simply by remembering, what to speak, even not saying the name of Krishna, even not seeing Krishna, even thinking of Krishna, one becomes internally and externally pure, as the well-known verse is there. which begins Sarva Vastan Kutupiva. Om Apavitra Pavitro Va. Om Pavitro Pavitro Va. Sarva Vastam Kutupiva. Yasmarer. Pundarika Ksham Sabha Yabhyantara Shuchihi. Whether one is from a conventional perspective, pure or impure, if one remembers the lotus-eyed personality of Godhead, then in all respects, he is externally and internally pure. So theoretically, one can worship the deity even without taking birth. You can just say, Hare Krishna, and then go and worship the deity. But, or even just remember, Pundarikaksha, then one can worship the deity. But there are rules of deity worship to maintain the proper attitude on the behalf of the performer. For devotees who are fully pure, they may not follow such rules and regulations, like Vamsidas Babaji Maharaj. He didn't have any rules and regulations in his deity worship. Nor did he chant any rounds, nor did he follow any rules, but he's completely pure. Nor did he bathe. Well, sometimes he did. If he wanted to, he did, but not regularly. So, still, he is to be considered fully pure because he always thinks of Krishna. Now, another examples are there. Ajamil, just by chanting the name of Narayana, was purified. There's a narration given in Sri Garga Sanghita of one king of Sindh who was extraordinarily sinful. Once he was out hunting, and a minister shot him dead with an arrow. In those days, not with guns. So he fell down, and just as he was dying, he hit the ground and died, and he went back to Godhead, even though he was killed. There's a whole list of his sins, which nowadays might seem just like an ordinary person having a good time on Saturday night, but is actually sinful. Well, killing people, he killed many people also. A king can and should kill under certain circumstances, but not in all circumstances. So anyway, he went back to Godhead. Why? Because when he fell down, what had happened? A Vaishnav had been there previously and had sat there and had made his gopi chandan for tilak, and some had fallen on the ground. And the king came in contact with that. His body came in contact with that at the moment of death. He was purified of all his sins and went back to Godhead. So purifying is Krishna, that even that which is in relation to him, that which is very dear to him, such as gopi chandan, just by touching that, one becomes completely purified. So we can imagine how pure is Krishna. And now another meaning of the name Pavitra, which is a completely different meaning. One who gives protection, Pavitra, tra means here, Trayate, as in Kshatriya, tra, Trayate, Paritrana. Who gives protection from the thunderbolt of Indra, which is called Pavi. So, Pavitra. So, if one is threatened with the thunderbolt of Indra, we can call out, Pavitra! And Bhagavan will deliver us. Not that we are likely to get threatened by the thunderbolt of Indra, as you're all devotees, but even anyone, why should Indra bother in this Kali Yuga with all the petty people here? He deals with big demons, not with little demons, like I used to be before Srila Prabhupada kindly picked me up, and I'm trying somewhat not to be. Now, there is a statement in Vedanta, Indriyanam Raja Indra. The king of the senses is Indra. So in this sense, one who delivers one from the thunderbolt of Indra, that means this is interpreted that the mind, which is dangerous for destroying all our attempts at advancement in Krishna consciousness. So Vishnu very kindly protects us against that, and therefore he's known as Pavitram. Then name 64, Mangalam Param. So this name means supremely auspicious. And this fits very nicely with Pavitra, because he's completely pure and completely purifying, then he's most auspicious. Because real people have different ideas of what auspiciousness is. We'll see on the outside the shops of in North India, they'll have written Shubh Lab. Shubh means just like this, Mangalam means auspiciousness, and Labha means profit. So these are the two aims of the Vaishya, that to lead, to have auspiciousness, which is generally, and to have money, to profit. These are things they're interested in. So auspiciousness is generally considered that we'll have a happy home life. We'll lead a pious life. There'll be many children. Of course, that idea has changed in the modern age, because now it's considered wrong to have many children. But according to Shastra, it is auspicious to have many children. And everyone will be healthy, and everyone will more or less cooperate among themselves at home, and will live comfortably and happily, and this is considered auspicious. However, it's not really auspicious at all, because that's all the illusory happiness of this material world. So real auspiciousness means to understand that everything auspicious and inauspicious in this world is inauspicious. And the only real auspiciousness is to go back home, back to Godhead, to Krishna, to be Krishna conscious. So that is supreme auspiciousness. And Krishna, because he's all pure, then he awards such auspiciousness. No one else can award such auspiciousness. He speaks Bhagavad Gita and gives us the knowledge by which we can understand what is the actual meaning of good and bad and auspicious and inauspicious. So in this way, Krishna is the supreme auspicious. He's pure means he has no ill intent, only good intent for all. And in this way, Krishna is all auspicious. That if we go to Krishna, even with a mistaken intention, that we think, I'll go to Krishna, and by Krishna's grace, I will attain auspiciousness. That means, just like Dhruva Maharaj was thinking, I will obtain a mighty kingdom. But Krishna is so purifying and so auspicious that he, even though Dhruva did not have any such intention, Krishna destroyed the desire within Dhruva Maharaj's heart, the material desire, and awarded him pure spiritual desire. So Krishna in this way is supremely auspicious, because he acts for the benefit of others, even against their own wish. So that's just like children. The parents are supposed to act for the benefit of children, even against their own wish. The children's desire is simply to play all day. And the parents send them to school with the mistaken understanding that it will benefit them, at least in the modern age. But at least the children have the idea that it's supposed to benefit them. So, anyway, that's another discussion altogether about the auspiciousness and inauspiciousness of mundane education. Actually, it's all inauspicious, but that is a different discussion. So, Krishna is all auspicious, so that even people who approach Krishna in enmity, they're also benefited. People who approach Krishna for whatever reason, akamo sarva kamo va, moksha kama, udara dhi, tivrena, bhakti yogena, yajita, purushamparam. Even people who approach Krishna being full of material desires, or if they have the inappropriate desire to become liberated without serving Krishna, still, if they approach Krishna for the sake of doing so, Krishna benefits them. And if they worship him with intense devotion, that's an important point to understand. That verse is often quoted by somewhat devotees or so-called devotees who think that it's okay to go on with a life of sense gratification and chant Hare Krishna sometimes when you want to. Quoting Sarva Kama, you can have all the but. The verse also says, "Tivrena bhakti yoga." No, one has to perform bhakti yoga with intensity, not with laxity. So the idea that we shall perform bhakti however we like, as much or more likely as little as we like, whenever we like, which isn't too often, and hari bol, that is not supported by this verse, although some people try to propound that. And another understanding is that even if people approach Krishna with mundane desires, Krishna also fulfills that. He may fulfill that. So all kinds, whatever one considers as auspicious, Krishna, one can approach Krishna. And whatever desire we want, if we have material desires, even then it's better to approach Krishna than any demigod. Because Krishna is the one who ultimately awards fulfillment of boons. As he states in Bhagavad Gita, mayaiva vihitan hitan. People approach demigods for fulfillment of boons, but the actual awarder is Krishna, and the demigods are simply agents in doing so. Hare Krishna. Any question about this, please? Thank you for your inspiring kirtan, which I came to just at the end. We need more of that, lots more, all over the world. Blast away all the impurities. Yeah.